a dear friend of the RPO and a returning artist to this city and to this studio as well. Welcome back, Orly Shaham.
Thank you very much.
Oh, so much. You know, it's been about 6.5 years.
See, I was trying to work it out based on the decor in the studio.
So, what's new? Actually, this is new. This wasn't here when you were here last, right? Weren't you sitting like in some dark room?
Exactly. You have sunlight here.
Yes, we do.
You know, musicians aren't used to sunlight. We tend to live in bunkers. We stay all day in the hall, which has no sunlight, and we come out only at night after the concert.
We have a sunscreen. We can bring it down on the window right as soon as we get the next piece of music up and running, if that'd make you more comfortable.
I'm actually enjoying the vitamin D. Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
I think the last time you were here was Mozart as well.
That's right. That's right.
So it's like a Mozart thing. Orly and Rochester and Mozart. Let's see, you worked with Jerzy Semkoff, then you worked with Christopher Seaman, and you're working with Christopher Seaman again. So I thought maybe we would start by asking you about the difference in conductors and what kind of impact that has with your performance when you come into any city to work with anybody.
You know, it really depends on whether it's somebody you know, somebody you've worked with, and how the personalities click. Christopher Seaman I've worked with quite a few times, and I just adore him. I love playing with him, and I come to a performance with him with a very different attitude than I would coming to a conductor that I didn't know. To him, I come and I say, here's what I like, but I want to hear what you like. Tell me what you think. Give me your suggestions. And, you know, in certain other instances, I might be saying something like, please leave me alone now. Let me play it the way I want to. No, but it's true that in this case, I have such a great respect for his musicianship, and he's always had the best ideas in all the concerti we've played together, that I come into it very much ready to make chamber music, which is really the most fun thing we do.
And you do sort of approach, I seem to remember this about you, your Mozart piano concertos as if they're chamber music.
Well, you know, Mozart approached them that way. I think he was leading from the keyboard, and he was ready to communicate, particularly with the winds, occasionally with the strings as well, but particularly with the winds, where he has, you know, interactions. This concerto has maybe fewer of them than others, but nevertheless quite a lot of places where I go back and forth. You know, I play a passage, and then the clarinet plays that same passage, and then I play it slightly differently, and the flute plays it slightly differently too. It's a wonderful, very intimate kind of music making.
This is, isn't this the concerto where he pulled out the oboes, which of course doesn't please me, and put in clarinets instead?
That's it. No oboes in this one, which means that when you tune in this concerto, you tune with a violin, right? Not to the oboe. Kind of an interesting twist. You're used to, usually you give the A, the violinist gets up, gives the A, and it's the oboist who takes it. But as there's no oboist, the violinist just takes the A from the piano and tunes the strings. Little things.
So this is a huge, huge Mozart year for you. Mozart seems scattered about your travels copiously. Is that on purpose, or is that just the way it worked out?
A little bit of both. You know, it seemed to start to work out that way, so I decided to make it on purpose. I had a number of requests for Mozart concerti, and I early on in my career, I did a lot of Mozart. And then for a while, I sort of consciously not stayed away, but minimized, you know, maybe one Mozart concerto, maybe two in a season, and the rest other things, big romantic pieces or more modern works. And it's like a homecoming for me. You know, I'm coming back this year. I'm doing, I don't have the count exactly, but maybe 6 or 7 different Mozart concerti, two of which are actually new for me this year. And that's incredible. What an incredible thing to be a pianist and be, you know, in my mid-30s, and there are still maybe a dozen Mozart concerti left for me to learn.
Is there when you're working on your Mozart concerti, and there are about, you know, what, 55 of them, so that's no surprise that you haven't learned them all. Is there a progression from the first one to where he's the 23rd one? Like Beethoven, there's a progression, right?
Mozart is a different kind of thing. Well, but, you know, Beethoven, there's a progression, but I think the progression is slightly backward. And of course, with Beethoven, the first concerto was written second, and the second one was written first. So that's always a confusing twist. And I personally think the fourth is the pinnacle, and the fifth is wonderful, but it's not the fourth. But that's neither here nor there. Yeah, Mozart wrote 27 piano concerti. And yes, there is a greater depth in the last maybe, dozen. than there is in the first. But that doesn't mean that that none of the first have that same sort of thing. But you do see a little bit what happened to him when he moved to Vienna and started to become a freelance musician, an absolutely unheard of concept at the time, you know, decided to actually just make his living as a pianist composer. That's why we have so many concerti, because he wrote them all for himself so that he could stun everybody with his compositional as well as his virtuosic abilities.
So can you tell what kind of piano player Mozart was when you're going through his concerti? Was he a...
He was good. He was very, very good. He had a good technique, you know, and he likes to sneak in, and he does this for other instruments as well, but since he did it for himself, he likes to give you passages of calm followed by suddenly a very difficult technical burst. And you'll hear in this concerto that we're doing this week, there's a burst like that for the bassoon, actually, where, you know, everybody's just sitting around peacefully and suddenly the bassoon comes out with four bars of nonstop fast notes. And it's a hard lick. And I have to say that the bassoonist today in rehearsal just nailed it.
Or perhaps Mozart doesn't like the bassoonist in his orchestra.
Actually, I think with Mozart, that could have been possible. But I think in this case, it was a friend of his. It was somebody he knew. And he wanted to give him a moment of shining.
So was he... can you tell the style, not just how good he was, but, you know, we have all kinds of pianists in the world. We have the hand slapping up, you know, big gesture pianists and the subtle ones that stay close to the keys. Can you tell how he actually technically played his piano? Would you guess?
You know, I guess, and certainly that influences how I interpret his music, but whether I'm right or not is hard to say. I think you can tell more by descriptions that have been written, that were written at the time of his playing. And people talked about, he didn't have the biggest hands. People talked about it, the fluidity of his fingers and the rapid movements and the sort of the grace of the style on the keyboard. So I don't think he was a slap the keyboard kind of a guy. I think he was very, very much about the beauty of playing as well as the music of it.
Now, Andrew Van Ooyen once talked about music fitting under his hands. And for him, he said Liszt fits well under his hands. If Mozart had small hands, I assume that Mozart fits well under your hands, Orly.
In many ways, he does. The one tricky thing about Mozart is he loved what I like to call finger twisters. They're like tongue twisters, only they're for the fingers. You know, it's when you suddenly become Chico Marx at the keyboard and your fingers are sort of all tangled up with each other. And he loved those things for himself. And although I enjoy playing them, I do find them very tricky. And I think that was partly why he puts them in. I actually think many times when Mozart was writing for himself to play, he was trying to keep his own interest by presenting himself with little challenges. I recently played the clarinet trio, the Kegelstadt, for which Mozart wrote the viola part for himself to play. And it is one of the most incredible viola parts I've ever heard. He was clearly a good violist and wanted to keep himself engaged intellectually and physically while he performed the piece.
So you have a choice. Somebody says to you, you can play Mozart or you can play Ravel. Which one's harder for you to do?
Actually, that's a really interesting choice of two composers because they present many of the same difficulties. They're very, very sparse playing, very sparsely written, which means that they're very naked. They're very... elegant and really using a great economy of notes and harmony in order to convey a great deal of emotion. So, in fact, I think in terms of the, you know, if I'm thinking about the Ravel piano concerto or a Mozart piano concerto, the feeling of playing the two is actually quite similar.
Our guest is Orly Shaham. We're going to actually listen to the middle movement of the Mozart Piano Concerto, number 23 in A, and then come back and talk about it. It's Women in Music Month, so I had to go female on this one. We have Mitsuko Uchida. She'll be playing the piano, and she'll be directing as well the Cleveland Orchestra. If you would like to attend an all-Mozart concert, who wouldn't? You can find out more information at rpo.org. Mitsuko Chida, playing the piano and directing the Cleveland Orchestra and the middle movement of the Piano Concerto No. 23 in A by Mozart. This is the concerto that is on the table with your RPO tomorrow night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8. And the pianist is our guest this afternoon, Orly Shaham. What an amazing piece of music that is.
Just gorgeous. You know, there's something about Mozart. The phrase exquisite beauty comes up with almost every piece of his that I play. And this particular movement is so special. You know, he takes advantage of the relationship of A major, which the concerto is in, to F sharp minor, and puts this key in this movement in this really far off, distant key. And you can hear that, you know, the kind of sound quality. It's actually very, very Ravelian now that you bring Ravel up in our conversation, to even use that kind of key. And he just spins things out so beautifully and so well balanced between the piano and the strings and a couple of notes here and there that he changes, and a huge bucket full of emotion comes along with them.
It's a funny movement because Mozart's middle movements are generally quite beautiful and often very lullaby-esque. I've just made a new word. This one, very different. What surrounds it is so different than what it is. And it has a sadness, a longing, something that seems so other than all the rest of the story that he tells.
No, it's really true. You know, rhythmically, it's very different from the first and third movements. It has this sort of pum, pa, pum, pa, pum, that kind of Sicilian rhythm. The other two movements are much more straightforward in the way their rhythm goes. They don't have that lilt. And the key and the dynamics of it are completely different than the other movements. It's really mostly very, very quiet. And although he occasionally has all the strings playing, it's very intimately orchestrated as well. He's just a master. You know, he would set his pen to the paper and put only what was necessary down on that paper, and it works so beautifully.
Some of these Mozart concertos are missing cadenzas, because he could just do it himself, no problem.
That's right, he would improvise them, but we're so lucky that this one, he wrote one down. Thank goodness I don't have to improvise my cadenza.
When you have a situation where you have to improvise a cadenza, you know that you've been given one of those, do you go find one? Because they're out there in some file drawer or
another. Well, I'll tell you, I'm not a composer, and my first my first line of defense is to see if somebody smart wrote one. And it's quite helpful, you know, for a number of the Mozart concerti, Beethoven wrote cadenzas, and so he's in a similar style, and he also obviously was a great composer. You can also go more far afield. I play a Saint-Saëns cadenza for the C minor Mozart concerto. But occasionally I've written my own. But when I do, I tend to stay pretty close to the source. Either they're the short cadenzas that don't go very far and just add one little twist here or there. Or, for example, later this month I'm doing the D minor, K-466. And in the third movement there, Beethoven did write a cadenza, but it's never been my favorite. And the opening tutti of the orchestra, so what the orchestra plays right after the piano starts the third movement, is my absolute favorite passage in that concerto. It's just incredible, filled with so much energy and vigor and excitement. And so essentially my cadenza is I rip off that tutti and I play it myself.
Good source. Can't get better than that. You have a Mozart this year that was new for you, Mozart Two Pianos.
Yes.
With another good friend of WXXI's and of the RPO's, John Kimura Parker. Has that happened?
That happened, yeah. We opened the season, actually, in Seattle with that.
And how was that?
Oh, it was just great. I mean, I've known him for a long time. We call him Jackie. I've known Jackie for a very long time. But we've never played together. Pianists don't get to play together that often. It's kind of an unusual thing. So we once did a tour in Florida where we were both soloists on the same program. And we, you know, we hung out and we saw movies and we talked about music. And we, you know, we're watching the DVD of The Phantom Menace backstage. It was right around when that stuff came out.
I had a feeling there was some sort of, you know, science fiction involved in this.
Yeah, there was a little bit of Star Wars involved. And we had a great time. And we knew this was a great collaboration. And so we went into the you know, to playing the Mozart Concerto for Two Pianos, we knew it was going to be wonderful, and it was. We had a great time. And in fact, we had such a good time that we're working on a sort of a tour and a CD project for, not for next season, but for the following season, so that we get to spend some time, go out on the road together and play together.
Now, this is two pianos as opposed to piano four hands.
Yes.
So there must be challenges in each of these that is unique to the art form.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you're playing with two pianos, there's no guarantee that you show up at a hall and two pianos have similar sound. You know, they have similar temperaments. Four hands, at least you eliminate that issue because you're playing just the one instrument together. But, you know, there are countless difficulties in playing two pianos together. You can't see each other's hands, for example. And not seeing each other's hands means you can't necessarily judge exactly at what speed your colleague plays a note. And you have to somehow match that, even though you can't really see much of it. So that's an important challenge. And then there's the fact that one piano will have a lid on it and the other one won't. And somehow you're trying to match sounds. And you want to go for a blend. You would like them to match, but you would like there to be slight differences. It's actually a lot of fun. All those challenges make it just more interesting, as far as I'm concerned.
So compare playing with another pianist with playing with another, I don't know, violinist. Maybe a violinist like perhaps Gil Shaham.
You know, it's a very different thing. Very different playing with another pianist. It's something. It's very personal. It's much more personal when you're playing with another pianist, because it is really testing how you approach your instrument. Whereas collaborating with other musicians questions how you approach music in general. And then you add to that the level of exactly how do you approach your instrument as well. And that's a wonderfully educational thing.
When you go out to play with other musicians, how well do you have to know them before you go out to play with another pianist, before you go to play with a violinist or another one? How well do you have to know them professionally even to be able to successfully put it together?
Not at all, if the mix is right. That's the amazing thing about collaboration in music is that it knows no bounds. It has nothing to do with your age, and has nothing to do with your gender, and it has nothing to do with your sexual orientation or your race or where you were raised. It really is a universal language. And if it turns out that you speak it in a similar dialect with someone, you can have an incredible collaboration right from the first time.
Now, how long does it take before you know that this is or isn't a working collaboration?
Usually you know within the first rehearsal. But occasionally I've been surprised at what happens after somebody's slept on the things you've talked about, and you come in the next day and you say, oh my goodness, I cannot believe you did this. I had an experience like that playing the Brahms B major piano trio once with an absolutely wonderful young cellist. And we came in the first day and he'd never played it before, and he played and it was fine, but it was not that interesting. And it certainly didn't have any of the depth that Brahms should have. And in the rehearsal, the violinist and I spoke to him a little bit about that, and we're hopeful that a little bit of that might come through. But I don't think either of us had any idea that the extent of how much of that he could just digest in one day. The next day he came to rehearsal, and I tell you, this was the most mature, most exquisite Brahms B major trio I'd ever heard. And I was shocked at just how much he was able to digest and put through his system and make his own in 24 hours.
And if you don't have that kind of a good turnaround, is it just chew the inner lip and get done with it?
I'm gonna withhold my comments to prevent further lawsuits.
Our guest is Orly Shaham. She's here to play Mozart from an all Mozart program. So this is a guy that you tend to work with from time to time, violinist Gil Shaham.
Who never heard of him?
Oh, he's some punk Cubbies fan.
Can you believe Gil is 39 years old?
He's not a punk anymore.
He's 39. Just turned 39. I just
And his so his Strad must be half paid off now.
Amazingly enough, I don't know how Gil did this. His apartment's not paid off, but the Strad is paid off.
Oh, priorities. I like that in a guy. We're going to listen to a little bit of Prokofiev from the CD that you and he put together here on Classical 91.5. Orly Shaham and your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra are playing together. They are collaborating tomorrow night and Saturday night with the pre-show chat, Christopher Seaman, 1 hour before curtain time, and tickets available by calling 454-2100. A little bit of Prokofiev with Gil Shaham and Orly Shaham, our guest.